and welcome to Plan Lehigh Valley. This program is presented along with our partners from the Lehigh Valley Planning Commission. And joining me, as always, are our co-hosts, Becky Bradley, the executive director, and the managing editor, Matt Assad. Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Today's show will take a look at the 2025 annual report with a special focus on the year in development. Joining us is Jill Seitz. She is the Chief Community and Regional Planner at the Commission. Jill combines a passion for data and information sharing to foster community partnerships that support data-driven decision-making. She's an expert on Pennsylvania planning, zoning, and land use, and has played a key role in impactful regional projects that include leading the Lehigh Valley Housing Supply and Attainability Strategy, the Lehigh County Industrial Land Use Guide, and Future LV, the Regional Plan. Welcome, Jill.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start with you, Matt. What is the annual report and why do you do it?
So the annual report's exactly what you would expect. It's kind of a summary of everything we did last year, all the plans, the analysis, all the events and workshops we did. One of the things I was surprised about is we actually hosted more than 80 public meetings. I was even shocked at that. The report sort of skims the waves of a very busy 2025. In fact, too busy for us to really talk about everything we did. So we're going to focus on the development side of things, like all the plans that were filed and all the trends that they showed. You know, people who follow us know it as Build LV. So we're going to focus on those things that people see happening in their neighborhoods and in their community.
Okay. And Becky, tell us who's interested in this and who can use it.
Well, we hope everyone is interested in it. But certainly our state government, our counties, and our local governments can find the report useful because it has information on what's happened in specific communities, what's happened in both counties, and how all of that then relates back to the larger narrative of our region and how that fits into the Commonwealth. But it's got all kinds of interesting information that we know the real estate community, the development community, banking community, nonprofits, and the community as a whole utilize in decision making in the nonprofit and the private sectors.
Okay, so Becky, let's dig into the development numbers and let's start with what everyone seems to be talking about, the housing shortage. Did 2025 do anything to change what we've been facing here?
It did a lot to change what we've been facing here. And in fact, last year, 5,919 housing units were proposed. And while a good deal of those were apartments, like 3,450 of them were apartments, we saw over 2,000 single-family homes, townhouses, and twins. It's 36 manufactured homes and 78 condos. Now, right now, as Jill has figured out, we're over 9,000 housing units short. So if all of these are built, this will go a long way to reducing that shortage. However, it doesn't fix it. And as our population continues to grow, we're still going to need to create units. We're still short some units if these get built, and they'll take several years to get built if they are all approved. But we still have to be mindful of that, and I think that's where some of the work that Jill and her team have been doing is so important.
Yeah, so Jill, the majority of these proposed new homes are apartments, as Becky said. Why do you think that is happening?
It's kind of been this way for several years now. I believe this is the eighth consecutive year that apartments have kind of been the major unit that we've seen proposed. And there's a few reasons for that. For one thing, our region really has had a need for newer apartment units. You know, we had decades of primarily single family homes being built in the early 2000s and then earlier than that. But our downtowns, which really could be the urban core of the cities, our main streets of boroughs, and our commercial centers in our suburbs, they all have the capacity to add apartments because they have existing infrastructure. And when people live near where they work or their school or their shopping destinations, it creates less of a car-dependent environment, and it's easier for people to get around. And so that's really popular for people looking to live in the region. We've known that across the region, natural resources and open space is one of the most highly valued assets. So we've seen many communities kind of move towards accommodating housing within those more developed areas because that helps conserve their farmland and open space areas that they have.
On the financial side of the equation, that housing downturn that we all want to forget that happened 2008, 2009, went through the early 2000s there, it had everybody really pull back in the financial sector from lending. And so lenders really started to focus on commercial real estate lending, which apartment developments fall under, is a safer way to lend than on individual homes and individual mortgages. Now, that conversation has changed substantially since 2008, 2009, 2010, but development lags those initial reactions and the swing away from risk to now we're in a more moderate risk scenario, but we're still dealing with the effects of that latent, that lagging kind of rescission from lending and risk in the housing sector. But again, it's changing. It's just not maybe changing as quickly as everyone would want, including the financial sector.
Right. So getting beyond apartments, Jill, what do the numbers show you about the types of homes that developers are building? Are there any emerging trends?
Sure, yeah. We are continuing to see a good diversity of housing types be proposed. For example, we've seen single-family detached homes and townhouses proposed at the same rate. So last year, we reviewed just under 1,000 units of each of those types. And as we've discussed, there was a time when single-family detached by far dominated new construction. So that's a pretty significant trend to now see an equal amount of townhouses and single family being proposed. Constructing more townhouses and twins gives both developers and communities flexibility to conserve land area, like for recreation, and it also can create additional variety in price points in different areas. We're also seeing developers branch out a bit more to promote condominiums and manufactured homes. Those are two types that we really seldom see, but they have been working to increase housing diversity in other communities across the state and the country. So last year, we reviewed 36 manufactured homes. Typically, they're in a single family format, but they can be easier and faster to construct because the pieces are built off site and then simply assembled on site, as opposed to more traditional stick-built housing that would be fully constructed on site, one stud at a time. And then we also reviewed 78 condominiums, which offer residents housing ownership opportunities in another form, because they could be in an apartment form, but they also really could be in single family or any other housing type.
Condos, I have not seen that in our reports before. I think we went years without having any condos.
You're right. It's been a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, so long ago, I barely remember, right? Like, I don't know, maybe 2010 or something like that. We had a few proposed, but it's been like that long.
It feels like there is a place in this market for them. Like, what's been happening? Why is that?
Well, I mean, condominiums rely on density. And so, again, it gets back to many of the things that Jill just said, but it also, another thing that kind of just builds off of what Jill said with, trying to conserve land, is the value of land has gone up as the demand for land has gone up as well. And so there is an economic factor to having, a mid-density type development or higher density type development. And I mean, look at all the wonderful things it's done for our cities, right? And even some of our suburban communities in having more diversified housing types. Because again, I mean, and I really, really think we should underline this, highlight this, put some exclamation points on the end. Something that Jill said earlier was that it allows for a variety of price points, which means we become affordable for everyone or more affordable for everyone. And ultimately, our goal as a region needs to be that we have housing available to everyone at every income level.
So, Becky, let's switch over to non-residential. Are we still in a warehouse boom?
No.
Ah,
No,
yay!
quick answer. That was the smallest answer Becky has ever given.
Okay.
Okay. Is that it? Is that it? Is there
Sorry.
more?
Oh, no, we are not in a warehouse boom any longer. However, we have always had a robust industrial economy for literally over 290 years. Like, we're OG industrial here. But the industrial now is changing. And I think that's what we saw from the development community last year. There is roughly 10.8 million square feet of all non-residential proposed, but of that, 7.2 million square feet was industrial. And this year, for the first time in many years, only 3.7 million of it was warehouse logistics, where before it was the vast majority. But we're starting to see a lot of different types. And it's one of the reasons why we issued an updated industrial land use guide just here about a month ago, end of December, beginning of January, and did training with all of our local governments and even had two community training sessions. Because the industrial market itself is changing. It's going into more advanced manufacturing. We have to think about uses like data centers, which we had one proposed last year. We've already had two proposed this year, and you'll hear more about that second one here soon. But the need in the industrial market is changing and it's evolving along with technology. So we can expect to continue to see that. But what we're learning is that, Wild West boom of big box development has very much slowed down, and it's more about what the market can bear and where.
Okay, and so along those same lines, Jill, are there other emerging trends that you're seeing in non-residential?
Well, I think the big one that Becky really mentioned and has become a real focal point of the community discussions we've had around the Lehigh County Industrial Land Use Guide is that emergence of data centers and really hyperscale data centers in the region. Because I think a lot of people in the region may not realize that data centers aren't really a new use, especially in other communities across the country and globally. There's been data centers as, we've increased our usage of the internet and computing, and now especially with artificial intelligence becoming more in the forefront. Really what we're seeing is just a larger scale of a land use that we've already had here. And so that's a conversation that we're having with a lot of the community is how to handle proposals that do come in at that larger scale. And we've also seen that because digital technology has become such a focal point of our everyday lives. So it makes sense that those land uses are seeking to expand and they do need to be close to population centers. They don't always have to be in the millions of square feet. They can come in all different sizes from just a few hundred square feet up to tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of square feet, similar to other scales of industrial, but that's really what communities are looking at with those emerging trends.
Important point there is they could happen anywhere. They could happen in a big giant rectangle that we all call warehouses, right? That's just a form of those flexible big box kind of developments. But they could happen in a former office tower in a city. They could happen in a strip mall. They could happen in a variety of locations. And in fact, they do. It just depends on the scale of what the community is trying to do. I think, too, overall, the industrial market has gone from a just-in-time mentality to a just-in-case mentality as well. And they're looking more towards resiliency and supply chain. And that translates to goods that you move around in trucks, right? Your Amazon deliveries and the other things you order online. But it also translates to technology and making sure that there's backups and resiliency, not only to a buffer from, natural disasters and other sort of natural hazards, but to buffer from cybercrime and other things that arise when you have a larger digital footprint and a more digital activity.
Now, the report shows more than 1 million square feet of proposals for commercial and public quasi-public development. What types of projects are those for?
On the public, quasi-public side, and as you mentioned, Margaret, we saw just about 1.3 million square feet of that last year. There's a few different types that fit into that category. And last year, in particular, what we saw was a lot of expansion in our school districts and charter schools, from expanding their learning spaces to upgrading their arts and athletic facilities. But that category also includes expansions to our healthcare systems, our hospitals, also medical office spaces. We've also seen several upgrades to municipal facilities like sewage treatment plants. And so all of those investments are really indicative of our growing population, where, we do need more local services, those schools, and more access to healthcare and infrastructure improvements. Similarly, on the commercial side, which we also saw just over 1 million square feet of, that's really reflective of some of the businesses and services that a growing population needs, like banks. Of course, with growth in population, we'll need more Wawas and Sheetz convenience stores. So we did see several of those last year.
Because there's only like five within a mile of my house. You have ultimate access to sandwiches. Good.
And that also creates more business opportunities for, we do see a lot of car-centric businesses like car washes, car service centers. We've also seen a lot of restaurants in that category and hotels.
I'm happy to hear about more car washes. I feel like I'm always driving really far to find a car wash that'll do it for me. Not, I don't want to do it myself.
Am I wrong? There is kind of like there was an odd spurt of car washes in the last 2 years.
There has been. There's a lot of conversation around entrepreneurs looking to kind of start a business. It's supposed to be a pretty popular starter business for people.
So Matt, beyond development, what else can people find in the annual report?
So everything else we did during the year, all of the reports we did, like the employment and population report, which we featured on this show at one point, all of the events we went to, I couldn't believe how many. We went to something like 30 events, and some of them are legislative hearings, and some of them are just lectures at colleges, and a lot of them are workshops, and a lot of the communities have us come in and use our expertise. So each of those is kind of on a timeline. We also have the 4-county, 2-state climate resiliency plan is in there, and the electric vehicle plan we did, and the housing strategy plan. So there's a lot of plans in there. And you only, again, we kind of skim the wave. You're not seeing the whole plan. Otherwise, this thing wouldn't be 60 pages. It would be, 760 pages. And there's also some stuff in there for the $543 million traffic improvement program and the global watershed management plan. Maybe the most interesting thing, and if you're sort of just your average person in the community, but in the back of the plan, there was a statistical look at every development that was filed in all 62 Lehigh Valley municipalities. So every single plan that was filed that Jill just talked about, you could see what was filed in your community. You can see how many houses were filed or how many square footage, is in there, and whether that stuff was commercial or industrial or whatever. It's all back there in a pretty neat few charts, and it's easy to read and easy to digest.
All right, let me just ask about one popular topic in this community that's been, a couple decades we've been talking about it. Passenger rail, is that in the plan or in the report?
Well, right at the end of December, we received notice that we would be receiving money from both Lehigh County and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania through Senator Miller, work with the Commonwealth to do phase two of the passenger rail project. So there is a federally outlined process to establish, or in our case, reestablish passenger rail. That you have to follow. And we did what we consider a phase one, which is identifying the process itself. That's in a report on our website at lvpc.org in the transportation section under a rail tab. But it recommends, well, it outlines all the phases, and then it recommends to do a phase two, which follows again that federal process. So once we receive a grant agreement from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we will start to outline this, what we're going to do next and put out a request for proposals to hire a third-party consultant to help us do that phase two. But what will happen in that phase two process is the federal government requires us to outline and to look at every possible route. So we'll be looking at the North Jersey route. We'll be looking at the route down to Philadelphia through the Philadelphia suburbs. And then we are required to look at the route out to Reading as well. It will allow us to figure out who a preferred operator could be. And that, you know, could be any transportation entity. And then it will also have us look at costs and then set out a strategy for phase three. Should it be acceptable cost operationally, route wise, to move forward into a phase three? But I think there's something like a dozen phases or more that you actually have to go through, including organizing revenue guarantees if we can even get into a phase three, four, or five. So you basically have to prove that you could make it through each of the levels of the process before it could even be considered to be reestablished. But nobody has ever gone through that. There's been a lot of folks that, you know, just said, hey, we want it, but it doesn't work that way, right? So we're being very intentional and making sure that we're following the process to see what we can do and if the project can move forward. And how it could move forward if it can.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't get there without this step.
Right.
Yes.
This study and this money that we got from, you know, through the legislature and the secretary, we couldn't move forward without it.
Right.
Yeah, it's absolutely imperative that we stay rational and that we follow a logical process, or we will guarantee that it will never happen. It's not enough to just say, I want. You have to figure out, you know, what the right route is, who could operate it, how are you going to pay for it? Do you have the money for revenue guarantees related to it? And so all of that is critically important. And look, it's not going to be an easy go. Just the steps alone are difficult. But the other component, I think, is like, how do you get the revenue guarantee for, you know, at least hundreds of millions of dollars? And that requires both federal and state legislative support in a time where we're in a very, very, very tax averse environment and a tax evolution, I would say, in how we're paying for things in the public sector. So all of these things are going to remain out there as things that we need to sort. And so I think that's important for folks to know, too. But again, very deliberative, logical, following the rules type of process, or it can never happen.
Gotcha. So it's early in the year. It's early in 2026. Becky, what are the trends that you're already seeing this year that might end up in next year's report?
Well, I think implementation of the housing supply and attainability strategy that we'll just be wrapping up with Lehigh County on behalf of the region here in the next several months. You'll hear a lot about that. I think you'll also hear a lot about implementation of some of our environmental and resiliency efforts, including the creation of a green infrastructure ordinance over the next few years through the stormwater management planning that we're doing. That's actually a super cool project. It has a weird name. It follows the name of the state act, which is Act 167. So, but really it's stormwater management planning. In the past, the state requirements have been to do a stormwater plan for every watershed. They take a minimum of 2 years each. We have, you know, 16 watersheds. We're responsible for 15 of those 16 because the 16th is a majority in another county. So they have primary lead. The watershed originates in Lehigh County. So we need to update those plans. Technology is actually allowing us to model all the watersheds at the same time and see how they interact, which was never a requirement. And so we can see what happens if we get more rainfall in one part of the watershed and what that means for the other watersheds that it's connected to and the like, because, you know, everything is connected to everything else. And at the end of this giant global Act 167 Stormwater Management Strategy, we'll be able to create a green infrastructure ordinance for the entire Lehigh Valley. So that will help us then reinforce those quality of life factors, especially around clean water, and support things like native planting strategies and other things that actually have benefit not only for clean water and water filtration, but for air quality as well. So that means once all of that's adopted over the next several years, that any new development that would occur in the Lehigh Valley would need to comply with that ordinance. And so I think that will ultimately help us maintain some of those critical things that the community has prioritized over and over and over again, which is, the environment and jobs. And I think that's one of the silent things that people don't necessarily talk about in the context of planning work, but a huge component of our industrial economy and our entire economy in the Lehigh Valley is based on water. And so making sure that those water protections are in place is also critical to industry, critical to our gross domestic product and jobs. And so this work is interrelated to other parts of how the Lehigh Valley works as well. So, I mean, I could keep going on the cool things that we're working on, but that in particular and some of the climate action resiliency efforts, which this is tied to, I think are very exciting. They may sound like nerdy things, and to some extent they are, right? What do they say? Nerds rule the world, right? But all kidding aside, you have to have a plan. If you don't have a plan, you don't have a future. And right now, with our growth and the pressures that the valley is experiencing, everything from infrastructure to the environment, to land to housing, all of that is under pressure. And so working on those main pressure points and trying to relieve pressure there or to manage that in a responsible way that keeps the quality of life and values and economy of a region together is imperative. And it's imperative, I would say now more than it ever has been. And the complexity and the interrelationship of all of those things is only increasing. And so us being able to have access to technology, model those things, bring it together, can make those connections is going to be important for the region's future.
Okay, so Matt, in 30 seconds, tell people where they can find this annual report if they want to dive into the numbers.
30 seconds. I can do that in like 7 seconds.
Go for it.
It is at lvpc.org/about-us.
Okay. All right. Well, that's our program tonight. I want to thank again Becky Bradley, Jill Seitz, Matt Assad for joining. You can always listen to this program again at wdiy.org or on your favorite podcast platform, and tune in throughout the year to learn more about what's happening in the Lehigh Valley. I'm Margaret McConnell with WDIY.